I'm your host, Clark Smith, a partner at Vela Wood. Each episode, we sit down with the trailblazer behind Texas's favorite drinks to dive into their personal journeys, career-defining moves, and the key business decisions that set them apart. Whether you're an aspiring alcohol entrepreneur or just love a good business success story, you'll get insider knowledge on what it takes to thrive in this competitive industry right here in Texas. So pour yourself a glass and let's uncover the sauce secrets. Welcome to Sauce Secrets. This is Vela Wood's podcast series about the Texas alcohol manufacturing industry. I'm Clark Smith. This is an incredibly special occasion where I'm meeting with my friends from Red Horn Coffee House and Brewing Company. It's Mr. John Lamb and Chad Meisner. This is going to be a unique experience. These guys are incredible guests to have. They have unique business perspective and, frankly, a really unique consumer experience that they bring to the table. So Vela Wood is extremely blessed and excited to be able to host them. And let me just hand the keg tap over to you two to like do some background introductions, talk about your professional backgrounds, and then I want to hear about that first light bulb aha moment that led to where we are today with Red Horn.
That was just yesterday. So yeah, real quick, this is John Lamb, and we founded Red Horn in 2014, opened in 2015. So we've been open just over 9 years. So kind of going back for me, I went to Texas A&M University undergrad, was a recreation and parks major, and I actually managed a coffee house back in the day in college, and I loved that experience. I loved everything about the third space at the coffee house that I worked at provided, and had that experience, and then got into the parks and recreation field right out of college and spent a couple of years managing parks facilities for the small town of Seguin. Always holding on to kind of that dream. That was my aha moment was, man, I would love to run a coffee shop one day. So anyways, I always kind of held on to that dream. And then fast forward, I ended up moving to the Austin area, got into corporate home building. It's where I met my wife, actually worked for a company for just under 10 years, Pulte Homes. Was in supply chain purchasing. But again, I always held on to that dream. During that time working there, I'll get into the story in a little bit, but I was actually laid off. 2007, right after my wife and I got married, less than a month later, I kind of learned that your future is not guaranteed in the corporate world. So you can walk in any day and be told what I was told. And so that was kind of a light bulb moment for me, one of them, after kind of this dream. I was rehired by the company. Thankfully, I was fortunate to go back and spend years there. But what it taught me was, again, my future is not guaranteed. And so it kind of, I guess, brought that to the surface and made me realize if my destiny is going to be controlled, I want to be at the helm. So anyways, fast forward, Chad and I met and we became friends through our wives, and he can go into a little bit of that story. But we had taken this dream and this vision. I'd become a big craft beer fan over time. Craft beer in the early 2000s was really making a boom. Breweries were starting to open. And we realized there was a beautiful synergy between craft beer and specialty coffee, and what the customer base was really seeing, a lot of synergies between the two. Economically speaking, we're like, this is great because you can, you know, have customers morning, noon, and night. So we had this full-fledged kind of idea. And for me, another aha moment before we opened was one of my closest friends died from cancer in 2013. And again, it was kind of one of the three legs, one of the things that kind of reminded me that our future is not guaranteed. You know, you only live once. We'll get into what our wives told us in a little bit, but I enjoyed my corporate experience. I enjoyed everything that my background professionally gave me. But again, there was always something there that was at the surface or just behind the surface that we wanted to get into doing our own thing. So we'll get into a little bit more of that, and I can let Chad share his background.
So John, real quick, you said that you're a Fighting Texas Aggie, former student.
Former student, Texas Aggie.
Do you know about the 12th man?
I do know about the 12th
man. Do you know about the 13th man?
I do know about 13th.
13th man is the guy that never graduated from Blinn and therefore never actually got into A&M, but never tells anybody about that.
Okay. Is that your version?
Chad, you can take it over from here.
John Lamb may have gone to A&M for about a decade, maybe?
Just shy of 8 years. Just shy of eight.
Yeah, I'm Chad Meisner. For all you Texas listeners, I'm one of those California transplants. Landed here in 2006 after graduating with a business degree at Cal State Fullerton. Wife and I got married shortly after graduating and thought we'd try something new, and landed in Austin, Texas for no reason other than we thought it was cool. So post-college, I knew I wanted to do two things professionally. One, own a business, and two, be a teacher. So it was just kind of my path, what I wanted to do. And I found my way into teaching through summer camps, after-school care programming, things of that sort. And that eventually led me into becoming a high school teacher and basketball coach. And all in that time that I was exploring teaching, I always had the entrepreneurial spirit and always have some crazy ideas going in a notebook or something about a business idea. And John and I were buddies, but mostly because we had to be, because our wives were friends. So we would meet up and hang out occasionally, but mostly it was over margaritas or bourbon or whatnot. And we did a family road trip to Destin, Florida. And on the drive back, my family with John's family in the windshield time, John and I realized how similar we were with our entrepreneurial mindset and ideas. And you could almost feel the relief from the backseat of Casey, my wife, and Sarah, John's wife, going, oh, hell yeah. They have someone else they can talk to now. So it was almost like we found our spirit animal in each other. So we came off that Destin trip and just kind of kept the energy going. And John had a business plan that was a coffee shop with some craft beer integrated in it. We dusted that thing off and it kind of just started to spiral. It was like, well, fuck it. If we're going to serve craft beer, why don't we brew craft beer? And then if we're going to serve specialty coffee, why don't we roast our own coffee? Like just vertically integrate out of the gate. So we put it on paper. And by that time, Sarah and Casey were really tired of hearing us talk about it. And they literally said to us, we support you guys, but if you're going to do it, don't half-ass it, go all in. So we quit our jobs. John quit his job, the day before Harris was born?
Yeah, my second son was due on April 4th, and I walked out. Well, I don't want to over-dramatize that. I walked out after 3-month notice, but I left April 3rd before my second son was born.
Yeah, and I finished my teaching contract that year, kind of took the students on the journey with me of startup mode, 2013, 2014, and off to the races we went. We weren't fully financially prepared to start a business, but my aha moment in that planning phase was the worst thing. This is probably a bad thing, but it's like the entrepreneurial mind. It's like, well, fuck it. The worst thing that's going to happen is we're going to lose some money. And whenever I became content with that, it was like off to the races. We were young enough where, hey, if we lose this money, if Redhorn goes upside down in 6 months, like we're young enough, I can mow lawns, we can recoup. We're not in retirement phase or anything like that. So that was definitely my aha moment.
Well, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there where that real terrifying hurdle threshold is that those initial funding, where is it coming from? Is it from a savings account? Is it from your recently retired Aunt Becky, friends that really like the concept? Talk about that. Any pitfalls that you didn't foresee that you were able to overcome? Advice for the person looking to start up an alcohol manufacturer in Texas at that real initial funding level?
I'll let John tell some of the details of the funding, but part of that was one of our early learning experiences that a bank won't talk to you without a lease in hand. Well, plenty of banks will like have a meeting with you and tell you no, but they don't know you're serious with no proof of concept until you have a lease in hand. So we signed a lease before we had full on this location that we're sitting
in
right now.
Funny story about that, actually.
You talk about putting your junk on the table and saying, we're here to play. That was it. And then after that, it was securing funding and other resources too.
Yeah, we'll get into the funding in a minute. Kind of a funny story about that. And I don't know if we ever told Mark, previous banker, the story, but we actually had a banner made. So we had signed the lease and we were trying to court this banker and let him know that we were serious. I mean, I think our meeting was at like 9 o'clock in the morning and we were meeting the banker here. There wasn't shit here. It was just virtually open space. Chad held him at the front door because I was getting the banner pro. We wanted to look a little bit legit, right? So I said, Chad, you got to hold off. I'm waiting for Office Depot to open to get our banner printed. Got it printed, held him long enough and had his back turned so I could pin the thing on the back wall. So when he walked in, there was kind of the effect of like, oh shit, we're legit. We're Redhorn. So just kind of a funny story. But the long and short of that is that bank, after 15 to 20 banks had told us no, finally funded us.
It was the banner, man.
It was the banner, man.
Shout out Big Irv for the design.
Still there. So yeah, funding, a lot of people will tell you, and one thing I'll kind of preface this entire conversation is there are million ways to skin the cat. Plus, everybody has their own unique experience, right? Everybody has different relationships, friendships, family relationships, etc. But we did tap into some of our network. We recognized that any money that was coming into this business was a risk. So we didn't want to go talk to grandma who was going to empty her savings account. You know, that wasn't the approach. But we were fairly young. We had some friends that were doing well. We had family that was interested in the concept. Similarly, had heard us talk for years about it and they had bought in. And so we were able to scramble 15 or so close friends and family to help put the money in order to then secure the business loan. So, right, any loan, you've got to have a certain amount down. We basically drained everything we had. Chad sold his truck and the truck he's still trying to buy back and bought my grandma's Prism, as a matter of fact, you know, the sacrifices we make. But I guess the point is we pretty much diluted all the stuff, that everything that we had, got some family and friends to invest, got the bank loan, and bootstrapped it. We did it with very little funding to get this thing off the ground. And I'd say pitfalls, always try to work in working capital. I think that's probably the one thing. You know, we made it, but you've always got to make sure you have working capital and runway ahead of you. It's always easy to be short-sighted and just think you're going to open tomorrow, but there's always after tomorrow.
So those early investors, anybody still on board?
Virtually all of them, except for one.
Yeah, and I remember those early conversations. Again, our first concept, right? Unproven. Everybody told us they were basically investing in John and I. The concept almost didn't even matter. They were betting on us as the owner operators. But we were taking money from people to try to grow this brand. And we looked everybody in the eye. I remember this vividly. And as the checks were coming to us, we said, nothing in your life changes if this never comes back to you. If you're okay with that wager, we'll take it. If you got any apprehension there, kid's wedding might have to change locations, or someone's not going to college, or whatever it changes, we're not going to take the money. Right. So everybody stroked the check and they're still on board. Still our backbone.
And, you know, thinking back to that time, we talk about throwing a rock at breweries, right? It depends on the market, but the coffee and beer scene has grown. It's evolved a lot in the past 9 years since we've opened. When we opened, people thought we were apeshit crazy when we talked about bringing coffee and beer together under the same roof. And I think this concept may have existed somewhere on the West Coast. Nobody's really roasting and brewing at the same time. Coffee roasteries were even really nascent at that time. Breweries were nascent at that time. So there were a lot of kind of new and upcoming trends, or I guess business models, that really hadn't shown themselves. So we really had to prove to a lot of people that what we wanted to do would work.
All right. One of my favorite parts of y'all's story, probably my favorite, Redhorn, where'd the name come from?
Creativity fatigue. Yeah, John and I, business planning, writing out all these concepts. My daughter Ainsley at the time was 4 going on 5, and Hudson, John's son, was, I guess, the same age, 4 going on 5.
And she's turning 14 tomorrow.
Oh, I don't. Yeah. I'm visualizing 5-year-old, sweet baby girl, not a 14-year-old teenager in my house. Anyways, we were dads. The wives were still working. We were trying to get this thing launched and burning the midnight oil after they would go to bed. And we would just run into challenge after challenge. It's two creative industries, coffee and beer. So every name you come up with, you go searching. Oh, shit. Somebody brewed a beer called that 3 years ago, you know? So
good old trademark law.
Yeah. So we were pretty set on a name. We had logos designed and we were sitting at the bar at Brass Top Round Rock. And the bartender goes, that's what you guys are calling your business? We're like, yeah. He's like, certain brewery just released a beer not too long ago called that. So we're like, damn it, scrap that idea. So we went to Hudson and Ainsley and basically said, hey, we need some fresh ideas here. Give us a color, give us an animal, see where this takes us. And
they were 3 and 4.
Yeah. Hudson wouldn't stop saying red. So he'd say red and Ainsley would say horse. Then Hudson would say red and they'd say monkey. And it didn't go on that long, but eventually got to Red Rhino. And we kind of were like, oh, well, that would be cool. You could do a rhinoceros with a red horn. Rhinos are kind of rare. They're kind of bold. They're kind of unique, kind of like our concept. And we called the attorney. We're like, red horn sounds kind of cool. He was like, I can get you a trademark on red horn. We're like, done. Lock it in. So red horn was born. Ultimately, it wasn't part of our original creative process, but we're pretty proud now because we're dads first and foremost that the kids named it.
How great did that first batch of beer or roast of coffee beans taste to you guys when y'all were able to test it out at the product launch?
Tasted like shit, probably.
Funny story is the first batch of beer brewed in this facility was actually dumped, wasn't it? Yeah. So we had to dump that batch.
Well, we salvaged it.
We salvaged
put it in wine barrels.
Yeah, we we soured it. Yeah, it tasted pretty phenomenal. As a matter of fact, we've evolved. Everything in this business has evolved, except us, maybe. We've just aged. But comparatively, what those beers were tasting like, Zach did an amazing job from day one, but a lot of things have changed. But what was really exciting was I actually saw the picture the other day of the first customer that bought the first Red Horn beer. And that was just as exciting for him as it was for us. So that was a cool experience.
Yeah, one of our first wins, aside from the obviously tasting your own product coming out of the coffee roaster and out of the bright tanks, was great. But in our business plan, we talked about the customer that would walk in here in the morning, get a coffee, breakfast, taco, pastry, whatever, leave their tab open because they're coming back in the evening for a beer. And that happened our very first day of operating with Rob Haig. Shout out Rob. He's still a customer. And we were like, okay, we put it on paper and it actually exists. So that was probably the first proud moment, like, okay, this could work.
Well, this is a perfect segue. So in my mind, makes y'all really stand out among the craft brewery industry in Texas is y'all's consumer and retail experience. It is entirely different than any of y'all peers or competitors in the state that I'm familiar with, because y'all have two different, I would say, complementary products, but they're different. How does having two completely different, but I think complementary consumer products play into how you view your customers, and how do you build your sort of future planning accordingly?
Honestly, I think you nailed it with one word, and that's experience. Chad will tell you there are a lot of priorities in business. You know, our team is a major priority, our customers, but quality of product to us is innate. We've got to produce quality product. At the end of the day, providing a customer experience is what's going to set us apart from any other customer. I mentioned the coffee house I worked at in college when I was a fighting Texas Aggie, Clark. It was the third space, and this was pre-Starbucks really making a ramp up in our market.
This is late 80s, early 90s, is it?
Yeah, I'm not as old as you, Clark. It's actually false. But anyways, the whole coffee house experience was something that I always hung on to. And when we kind of saw the coffee industry growing, there were a lot of drive-thrus and a lot of small, tiny shops, not really inviting. And when we designed this place to be more of a third space and a hangout, that was really what we focused on, was the experience. Because you can open a tap room a couple of days a week and have really great beer. You can open a tap room all day long, every day. And we take just as much pride in our coffee and what our roaster does as we do in our beer. So again, it really provides us the opportunity to give people an experience, whether you're a drinker or not. Kids can come in and have a hot chocolate with their parent. One has a coffee, one has a beer. But at the end of the day, they're all getting the same experience.
Yeah, and we knew from planning phase, there was an overlap of the two demographics, specialty coffee and craft beer, from the consumer standpoint, right? So it's your ideal Venn diagram. A lot of people will fall right in that middle. So it just made a lot of sense to us to take a dollar in starting at 7 a.m. every morning instead of just relying on the evening business. We're as proud and as happy about our coffee program as we are our beer. And breaking news, the margins on coffee are pretty nice.
I can imagine.
And the laws are a lot less restrictive too.
I definitely know. I definitely know that that's the case.
Yeah.
So I'm racking my brain. I think that the first time I came here and got to meet with y'all here was early summer 2020. And obviously there was a lot going on in the world and in y'all's industry at that time, right at the onset of COVID. And you talk about turning the consumer experience world completely upside down. Y'all weathered that storm and you weathered it extremely well. Of course, your Scottsdale location, you opened, I think, in February of 2020, or at least you signed the lease. Y'all have overcome that a lot. I think a lot of the business or business concepts that are coming up, they don't have to just necessarily, they're not thinking about the consumer experience pre-COVID, and God willing, they're not thinking about the experience during something like COVID. What do y'all think that has changed in June of 2024 versus, well, not just June of 2020, but you know, June of 2019, and for better or worse?
I've tried to remove that time period from my memory, so let me go deep in the file cabinet there. Yeah.
Good, bad, or indifferent. I will tell you something. I'll never forget a conversation I was having with my wife. I was standing behind the shop and it was 2021. I had this realization that before COVID, and I'll say this, I'm so tired of the pre-COVID, post-COVID bullshit, but reality is I never before that felt like I had to look over my shoulder, if that makes any sense, until that point. And since then, I've always felt like okay, what's next? What's coming? I felt like it was such a beatdown. I felt like since then, there's just always been something looming. You just never know. Like that came out of nowhere and just drop kicked everyone. Not just us as a business, but I guess it just kind of raised awareness for me. And we just have to always be prepared for anything. And that's an unsettling feeling in a way. But I think the positive thing for us, you mentioned it, we signed our lease 3 weeks before the bottom of the fucking earth fell out. It also taught us you just got to keep moving. And so I can tell you this for both of us, Chad and I thrive on momentum and we thrive on creativity and we thrive on creating. And we have less time to do that these days because business takes a lot to run, right? There's so many hats that we have to wear. But we constantly tell each other the momentum and the forethought and the ideas and the innovation, that's what keeps us going every day. And so I've forced that to help drive me more so than I ever had before.
One of the things that comes to mind for me is I hang my hat on we're driving this ship. As entrepreneurs, as the founders of this company, if this thing goes down, it's because of us, right? If it thrives, well, it's because of a lot of other people, but we're at the forefront of it. And those times, it was a gut check because there were these outside forces that we had no control over. That was a really hard pill to swallow as an entrepreneur. And we were thriving. We signed the lease on that other space because we were growing, right? We were hitting every benchmark. We were growing rapidly. And then insert March of 2020. And it was just a gut punch because you're constraining me as an entrepreneur and as a visionary to take this thing forward, right? And a lot of people had really bad times. I get it. But just as an entrepreneur, that was really hard to deal with. Really tough times.
He all weathered the storm better than most, I would say. You know, I got to know you guys while I was at the Alcoholic Beverage Commission working as the general counsel. And so I saw things from a completely different perspective. But it was also, it was still, even if on the sort of regulator sidelines, it was terrifying to look and see what was happening to the Texas manufacturing industry. You guys have been up and running for 6+ years, but there were countless small manufacturers that had just gotten off the ground and previous 12, 18 months, and they just opened their tap room or they had just started self-distributing or you name it.
In planning phase, exactly.
Yeah. They had just taken the check from Aunt Betty.
Yeah.
And so I know it was a tough time, and I'd like to think that the industry and kind of the entrepreneurial mindset is calibrated enough now that hopefully that storm, should it ever come again, can be weathered.
Well, when you talk about the entrepreneur part, right? The sometimes ugly side of the reality. Most of these small businesses like us, those owners have personal guarantees on their lease. So you pull the carpet out from underneath us in March after we're just kicking ass. We're looking up and going, this whole thing might be over. Now I got to go home to Casey. John's got to go home to Sarah and say, hey, all that retirement money we took, hey, investors, all that money we took, it's done. And by the way, John and I are going to be paying on a lease for the next 4 years that we can't operate a business in. That shit's hard. Thanks for the therapy session, Clark.
Thanks for the therapeutic beer here. The podcast is called Sauce Secrets. Can't finish this thing without asking y'all about your sauce. First and foremost, the coffee. What's the process? How do y'all choose your beans? How do you roast them? How do you personally consume them? And let's talk about the beer also. You guys have amazing selections. Every time I'm here, I see a dozen different types of beer and funky names that I'd never seen before. So what's the secret to the sauce?
Hey, man, you just said it's a secret. We can't go tell everybody. So let's start with coffee. I will tell you that we can sit here and talk about it, but we want to give credit to our amazing teams. Marco, one of our business partners, is the head of coffee operations, and Taylor Steidel is our coffee roaster. And Steidel's been roasting coffee for a few years now for us. So when we opened Red Horn, back to Chad alluding to this earlier, we decided let's roast our own coffee. It was new and it was something that we were excited to learn alongside our customers and learn alongside each other. So we went and got trained, flew to Idaho, spent a week in Idaho, fun trip. We had a really good trip to Idaho and actually got to spend time in kind of a unique part of the story. You go to breweries and you see brew houses, right? You go to a coffee roastery, there's a coffee roaster. And we got to actually get trained by the guy who created our roaster and designed it. And so it was really cool to go through that experience with the engineer and the guy behind it. So anyways, Chad and I were behind the roaster when we first opened up. So we started sourcing our beans through a coffee broker. We work with two, sometimes three coffee brokers to bring green beans in from all over the world. And we're still small. We support our shop. So, you know, we don't do a whole lot of wholesale, but we just started learning. We started picking up really cool coffees, small lot coffees, and we can roast them right there on stage. And what's really cool about that experience is, I don't know if y'all have ever been to a coffee roastery, but that's where it happens. You know, a lot of people have been to shops, but you have not been to a coffee roastery where it's actually being roasted. So we get our green beans in. The coffee roasting process is about, what, 12 to 14 minutes for a batch. We roast about 8 pounds at a time, and we've gone from roasting a few hundred pounds a year to, we're like 10 to 12,000 pounds a year, which is pretty phenomenal, mostly supporting our own shops. But yeah, so that's the process. You bring green beans in, we do a lot of sample roasting, and we can get some sample batches in, and we just dial it in, because something we love about coffee is the purity of it and what these farmers, there's so much that goes into. We got to visit a coffee farm we have a relationship with in Costa Rica, and to see the amount of work and time that goes into not just harvesting the cherries that coffee comes from, but growing the plants. It takes years. And so we wanted to really take care of what all of these people are doing with their coffee. And so we bring it in, and we're purists with beer. We're purists with coffee. We'll make anything you want, but we love to share exactly what those farmers intended in all of the origins coffee. So we've got coffees that have a huge blueberry note to it, and that has nothing to do with what we put in the coffee. That's the coffee itself. So I could go on and on, but all to say that we've loved being able to be a part of that process from start to finish.
I really believe in nearly 9.5 years of having the doors open is our secret sauce is that we're a community space. We put a lot of pride in producing our coffee and how we roast it and how we brand it and how we pull an espresso shot. There's one way to pull an espresso shot at Red Horn. Like, we have all those processes. We have a lot of pride in what we do on the beer side. We have American light lagers to hazy IPAs to barrel-aged stouts to German-style beers and ESBs. We do it all. Sometimes we brew beers that we want to drink. A lot of times we brew beers that we know there's a market demand for. But at the end of the day, our secret sauce is that we're community-driven. We're a little more pure when we first started because we thought that was our identity, but our community has kind of shifted our identity. And an example of that, right now we have a coffee drink that we make with Fruity Pebbles.
True.
9 years ago, we would have said, leave that shit to Starbucks or Dutch Bros or somebody else. That's not who Red Horn is, but we've pivoted. You have to be nimble in this market, right? And guess what? Our community wants fun stuff like that. So we do some crazy shit like that because we hear people. And more importantly, we want everybody to feel comfortable here and that they have a seat. So whether you like wine, whether you like a light American lager, whether you like you're a hophead or like Fruity Pebbles in your coffee drink or a pour over, we kind of got something for you.
I wanted to go over something else. You kind of brought up a thought for me, Chad. There was a time going into a craft brewery, and for a lot of people, this is still the case. You might go into a craft brewery or you go into a distillery, you go into a coffee shop that really takes pride in what they're doing. There could be an intimidation factor. And something we've learned about customers is not everyone is willing to engage. So it's our responsibility. It's our team's responsibility to engage with customers and share what we have to offer. Not everybody's going to ask, but one thing that we've always said was, you know, you mentioned Starbucks. A lot of these places have given us the place that we have today. If it wasn't for a Starbucks of the world, coffee shops wouldn't really exist. However, they come to us for something different. So we have to make sure that we are not snobs about it. No different than a craft brewery. You go in and ask for, I'm not going to say a beer name because I don't want to give them the credit, but you ask for an American light lager at a craft brewery. And some people are afraid that they're going to get shunned for it. Same thing with coffee. They ask for a caramel macchiato. We're going to serve something different, but we're going to talk about it. I guess my point is we didn't want to be snobs about it. And we told all of our team from day one, let's make sure everybody feels welcome and make sure that they're not intimidated to ask, what the hell is a craft beer? What is specialty coffee? What does roasting mean? Because a lot of people come in and don't know that. So we wanted to be inviting and welcoming. So we're not going to sit back here and talk shit about competitors or customers. We want to make sure that everybody is welcome. We want to educate consumers. And that's what we're here for, because this could be the first experience that somebody's had in a specialty coffee shop or a craft brewery. And so that's always going to be the case from now until the end.
Yeah, I think what's really important, based on reputation of the industry, we've made a lot of progress in the craft brewing industry, especially coffee industry too, in 2024. But there's still a little bit of a snob tag associated with going to a brewery or going to a specialty coffee shop. And I think maybe what people don't recognize is if you peel back every layer of the onion, we're in the hospitality industry. The beer can be phenomenal. The coffee could be great. The bourbon can be wonderful. Whatever. They can have a connection to the brand somehow because they invested in it or it's down the street from them. But if you don't take care of people and make people feel comfortable, you don't have shit to stand on. So I think that's kind of the core of everything is try to make people feel good. We think Redhorns people, well, what used to be third space, not everybody has an office anymore. So it's kind of like your second space, but
we're first.
Yeah, we're first. But yeah, it's really important to focus on the hospitality and how you make people feel with your product and with your service.
Completely agree. And again, that comes down to consumer experience and y'all are people persons first and foremost. And that certainly shows in the dozen times I've come and visit with you guys here and at your Scottsdale location. Absolutely. All right. So final question. This one's an open-ended one, but what's the topic for the brewery industry that nobody's talking about right now, but that people either should be talking about or are going to be talking about in the not too distant future?
There's a lot of vulnerability in this industry. A lot of people get into it because it's hobby driven. It sounds fun. Oh shit, I brewed beer at home and I want to go open my own brewery. I've owned this brewery for 9.5 years. I've never brewed a beer in my life, not even at home. We got into Redhorn. John had a specialty in operations, finance. I had a background in hospitality and maybe some business. We hired Zach as a partner who ran the beer program. Marco came on board to run coffee. So I think identifying those specialty areas, because you got to wear a lot of hats in this industry. And I think there's a little bit of a shakeup going on with maybe some people that got into it ill-prepared or thinking it could just be a hobby. There's not money to be made in this shit if it's just a hobby. You got to run it and treat it like a business. So I think that's being talked about a little bit more, but I'm afraid of in the next 2 years, there might be even more of a shakeup. Any market's going to correct itself, right? There was a huge boom 2015 to 2018, 2020, and we're seeing some of the shakeup happening now. So I think a market shift is kind of inevitable. And I hate to say that and hate to see it, but it takes some business acumen and we're not perfect. We're going to get off this podcast and have to put out how many fires tonight, but it's vulnerable. It's a vulnerable industry.
I don't know that there's a whole lot people aren't talking about in our industry. Something is out there and people are talking about it, but it's what are people like that, the vulnerability, what are people afraid of? And I think that's the thing. It's what are we a little bit afraid to talk about? And that's the market correction. What are things going to look like? Who's really focusing on the experience? Who is just really focused on what's next? The consumer experience has even changed. You know, a lot of little things have changed over time. I was at the grocery store yesterday. We are very fortunate to be in conversations with retailers across the state, and especially in Central Texas, very fortunate because I took a photo of the craft beer section in a very well-known retailer that is now less than 4 feet wide. You know, and so this conversation about craft beer and what your intentions are getting into distribution, you know, Clark, you've seen it a lot. It's really challenging. So I think now, to Chad's point, it's really seeing where everybody's plans kind of fit in. And over the years, we've seen a lot of change in the business model itself. A lot of brew pubs have started to open up because people have kind of realized that distro is hard. Distribution is low margin. It's cutthroat. You're fighting a lot of laws and a lot of distributors. But what you can always control is your consumer experience right there in your tap room. And so I think back to market correction, I think it's just going to continue to evolve to a place where we're back to focusing on tap rooms still.
When we started in 2015, customers were tolerant of less than stellar products. There wasn't as much market saturation. So you can almost get those favors from the customer base. Hey, support us. We're growing. Tell our story. But at least in this area, Williamson County, Austin, Texas, there's a lot of really good beer. There's a lot of really good coffee. So if your product isn't top notch, they'll try it once. They'll buy the 6-pack of Hap Slappy off the shelf at the local retailer. If it tastes like shit, they're just not going to buy it again because there's plenty of other options. So you're dealing with that in the industry as well.
Yeah. And you have to imagine back to the grocery store shelves, you're seeing the impact that anybody's seeing in this market is probably not different from a lot of the impacts that people are seeing in other states, right? And so you're not only competing against really badass products in the state, but now more products are coming in from California. We've seen our personal distributors' portfolio grow compared to what it was a few years ago. And again, everybody's looking for market share.
Yeah, the shelf space doesn't grow, even if the potential occupants of that shelf space does grow.
Yeah, and digital shelf space, kind of what I've talked about with some team in the past, is a new thing. Consumer choices and consumer behavior. Raise your hand in the room if you've done online curbside pickup for your groceries. Well, guess what? When you're doing online curbside pickup, no longer is your product front and center on that grocery store shelf the way it was a year ago, less than 2 years ago. So now you have to really change how you're in the face of the consumer to make sure that when they're online shopping, they're buying your product versus walking up to the beer shelf. So it's a whole different style of shelf.
Chad and John, thank you guys so much for hosting us here at Red Horn. This has been absolutely fantastic. Y'all's perspective and experience is going to be priceless to our audience. And look forward to meeting with you guys again.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
The Vela Wood podcasts are recorded with the help of Radio MD, based in Chicago, Illinois. You can find all of our podcasts on our website at velawood.com/podcasts. For questions, comments, or suggestions, email us at podcasts@velawood.com.